This is Annalisa from Toronto, Canada. I'm totally stoked that there's a new episode of the Professor Buzzkill History Podcast. Join me in listening to Professor Buzzkill as he busts myths and takes names.
Yes, indeed, Buzzkillers, it's Professor Buzzkill here. We're talking about all kinds of things, history, myth busting, correcting misunderstandings in history. And this has been such an important and fraught few weeks in world history. And I thought it'd be really nice to have a specialist in modern Chinese history come on the show. So here we have Professor James Carter from St. Joseph's University, who's here to talk to us about Hong Kong. Professor, thanks for coming on the show.
It's my pleasure. I wish were better circumstances, but that's easy to say about a lot of places these days.
Well, exactly. And we're going to talk about, or I should say, by we, of course, I mean you. We're going to enlighten us about the 19th century and early 20th century backgrounds to all the things that are going on in Hong Kong right now. But I think it's important, especially given the fact that so many inflammatory things are happening right now. It's important to remind the Buzzkillers what's actually happening, has been happening in Hong Kong in recent weeks.
Yeah, so there's a lot, as you say, going on every place. And it's there's a couple different anniversaries going on right now, and that's driving a lot of the protests at the moment. So the biggest one, the one that folks listening to the show will probably be familiar with, is the anniversary of June 4th, 1989, which was the Tiananmen Square massacre in Beijing, and all across China there were protests. That was commemorated in Hong Kong. Hong Kong was the only place in the People's Republic of China where you could publicly commemorate that event. And that had been going on for, well, ever since 1989 happened. So 1990 was the first one. But this year was the first time that it was forbidden from taking place, supposedly because of COVID-19 concerns.
Right.
And it was banned from taking place. It took place anyway. So there was a protest. There was a commemoration. And how that's playing out is still live. But then the other anniversary that is being commemorated right now is the protest that began June 12th of a year ago. And those have to do with protests against an extradition law that would permit Hong Kong citizens to be extradited to other parts of the People's Republic of China. And it is tied into the whole question of Hong Kong's autonomy and its relationship to the rest of China. So for the past year or so, Hong Kong has really been embroiled in protests that have at times involved millions and millions of people. And that's something that is, as we look at what's going on in the United States right now, it is a reminder that protest is something that is just worldwide at the present moment for some similar reasons, but also for some different reasons.
Right. And these protests in Hong Kong bring up this whole question of the status of Hong Kong, and if you will, maybe even Hong Kong identity and Chinese identity overlapping. Can you take us back to, say, the 19th century origins of all this? I've always been fascinated how relatively recent, and of course by recent I mean the 1830s, the situation in Hong Kong sort of starts. We think of it as going as being ancient, but it's not ancient.
No, it's and Hong Kong is unique, and it has a unique relationship to China and a unique relationship to the rest of the world. So probably the place to start with Hong Kong is in the early 19th century. The early 19th century is a time when China is starting to transition from being the world's most probably the world's most developed economy, or at least one of the world's most developed economies, which it was in the 18th century. And as you turn into the 19th century, it's starting to be overtaken by Great Britain. And so the British are starting to have a different attitude toward what's going on in China and about their relationship to trade in China. And so that leads to, in the middle of the 19th century, starting in 1839, something that your listeners may have heard of, which is the Opium War.
Right.
So the Opium War is something that is really crucial to the development of modern China. In fact, if you are in China and you study modern Chinese history, the modern era begins with the Opium War. And what they call modern China really is defined by something that's referred to as the Century of Humiliation. And that goes the 1830s to the 1940s. And that is defined by unequal treaties, as they put it. Which give a lot of Chinese land, a lot of Chinese territory, a lot of Chinese sovereignty over to European countries and also the United States and also Japan. But Hong Kong becomes central in that because out of the Opium War, which ends in 1842, Hong Kong is given to Great Britain as a colony. There's a couple of other provisions in that treaty, which we can, which we may talk about. But in terms of Hong Kong, what's important is that in 1842, Hong Kong becomes a British colony. And Hong Kong is given to Great Britain in perpetuity, so forever, which we'll have to address why it went back in 1997, which is sort of what, you know, where else is pointing.
So the treaty you're talking about is the famous 1842 Treaty of Nanjing. That seems to be not only disputatious at the time, but seems to sort of explain why the rest of the 19th century, helps us understand why the rest of the 19th century is fraught in Hong Kong.
Yeah, the 1842 Treaty of Nanjing, or Treaty of Nanking, it's the same place, just with different possible spellings, is part of a whole raft of treaties that are signed between China and European countries. But what comes out of it is that Hong Kong becomes a British colony in perpetuity. And that piece of that island is disputed by both sides as terms of being part of the resolution of the war. So neither side is happy about it. The Chinese are unhappy because they're giving part of their territory over to another nation. And the British felt that they won the war, they should have gotten something better. There's a famous quote from Lord Palmerston, who's the foreign secretary in London, who essentially says that this is never going to amount to anything. Like, there'll never be any trade at this place. There's never going to be any opportunity, no prospects. And both the people who negotiate the treaty on both sides, they get censured by their governments.
So it's funny, the Lord Palmerston quote is amazing because it's exactly perfectly wrong, because Hong Kong becomes perhaps the biggest trading spot in the entire world after certainly by the 20th century.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, the quote that he says is, you know, he says that Hong Kong is, he says, quote, a barren rock with nary a house upon it. And pretty early on, it's not clear what its prospects are going to be. Shanghai, which is becomes really the biggest port on the China coast, it was not expected to be what it became. But Shanghai and Hong Kong and the other ports really start to grow as part of this trade that develops between China and Europe in the middle of the 19th century.
Right.
And then another piece gets added to it a few decades later in the 1850s and 60s, which is part of the Kowloon Peninsula, which is kind of right across from Hong Kong Island. So think of that as maybe the Brooklyn to Hong Kong Island's Manhattan. And then the important part for the rest of our story becomes the Convention of Peking or of Beijing in 1898. And in 1898, you get this huge part of what's now Hong Kong, which are called the New Territories, and they're still called the New Territories 100-something years later. And that comprises about 86% of the area of Hong Kong. And that's given to Britain in 1898, but it's leased. So it's a 99-year lease, which, to be honest, everybody assumed that 99 years was forever, and so they weren't really planning on giving it back. But imperialism is starting to be a little harder to justify just flat out. And the Chinese are hesitant about giving over some more territory. So in 1898, the British leased this big part of, mainly it's the mainland and a few islands as well. But that completes the territorial boundaries of Hong Kong in 1898, which has an expiration date of 1997.
Okay, so does that mean that 1898 lease for 99 years is only for the new territories, and that the original little island of Hong Kong, in theory, could still be held in perpetuity?
Not just the island itself. So there's three pieces, right? So the first piece is Hong Kong Island. That's in perpetuity. The second piece is the Kowloon Peninsula, which is at the very tip of the mainland. That's also given over in perpetuity. That's the piece that's added in 1860. And then the rest of the rest of Hong Kong, the new territories, that's leased, in theory. That has to go, that, or at least the lease expires in 1997. But in theory, the rest of Hong Kong could stay British, in theory.
And so was there any sort of, I don't know, dispute or discussion, at least in the British cabinet, saying, well, even after 99 years, we'll still have these, the Hong Kong Island and part of the peninsula.
So then you have to move ahead quite a bit into the 20th century, because Hong Kong becomes the Hong Kong that we know, or at least that we knew until a couple of years ago, after World War II. Because after World War II, and Hong Kong was occupied by the Japanese during the war, and in fact there was quite a bit of discussion as to whether or not it would go back to China after World War II, because after all, the Chinese were fighting along with the Allies during World War II. So the idea that this colony would be taken would be taken by an ally from another ally is a little bit odd. But the British aren't going to give it back. They don't give it back. And so after World War II, Hong Kong booms in a way that's kind of hard to imagine. A lot of that has to do with the influx of people and capital from Shanghai in particular, from the mainland, but especially from Shanghai. And so Hong Kong during the second half of the 20th century grows up as this little perch of European colonialism on the edge of the People's Republic of China. Whereas remember, after World War II, there's the Communist Revolution. Right. So now China becomes communist, becomes the People's Republic of China. Taiwan, which we're not really going to talk about much today, but that was, you know, that was the piece that remains controlled by the nationalists who had fought with the Americans and the British and the French and the Soviets during World War II. And then Hong Kong, which is this little piece, but becomes kind of a gateway, a portal between the mainland and the rest of the world. And it was sort of tolerated by both sides. In fact, during the 1950s and 60s and 70s, there was sort of not a lot of discussion about it. It's like it's there, it's working for both sides. And I think the British, to answer your question from earlier, I think the British did sort of allow themselves the idea that maybe we can keep this going. And that was definitely a thought they had.
Let me ask this then. I'm sure Buzzkillers would like to know how Hong Kong succeeds so well as a trading post and as a center for trade. It seems to me that, well, geography is a very, very important part of it. But are there other things going on that make it really sort of boom after World War II?
The biggest piece is the influx of capital and people from the mainland. So if you had to give, so what are the reasons for Hong Kong's success? The most important reason is the energy and the money and the expertise that's coming from China. I mean, a huge number of people fleeing World War II, which, you know, they're just fleeing, but then fleeing the Civil War and then fleeing from the communist government. And so a lot of those people, just people and companies just lift up altogether and move from Chinese cities, especially Shanghai, to Hong Kong.
So that's we should remind the buzzkillers, the Chinese Civil War is after World War II between the communists and the nationalists in 1949-ish.
Yeah, so officially the nationalists and the communists are fighting together during World War II. That was always an uneasy relationship. And then so from 1945 until 1949, they have a civil war that ends in 1949 with Mao Zedong, Chairman Mao proclaims the founding of the People's Republic of China, and what's left of the nationalists, they flee to Taiwan, which is still in place, the Republic of China. That's the arrangement that's been in place ever since.
Okay, I think this is a good place for us to take a sort of a sponsorship break, and then after we come back, we'll talk about how things develop in the 60s and 70s and then all up until the most recent disturbances. So Buzzkillers will be back in a moment. You loyal listeners often ask me over social media to recommend podcasts to you. And boy, oh boy, do I have a good one for you now. It's called Heaven Bent from the Frequency Podcast Network. It's about a bizarre spiritual movement that spread across Canada a few decades ago. Worshippers shaking, the falling to the ground, faith healing, gold teeth miraculously appearing in the mouths of the faithful. But did any of that actually happen? Join Heaven Bent's great host, Tara Jean, as she journeys back over that territory and back over the past to find out.
This is the most significant spiritual event in our generation.
People were making animal noises. People would start laughing and falling down on the floor.
Thousands of teenagers just praising God and screaming and shouting and holding each other up.
I execute judgment on you, COVID-19.
I'm just fascinated by what the Holy Spirit does.
Yes, Jesus.
People want to believe.
If God can turn water into wine, he can turn teeth into gold.
It's like people don't know what's in their mouth.
God makes the purest of the pure. He does the best of the best always.
In Jesus' name, thank you, Lord.
Find Heaven Bent wherever good podcasts are available and at frequencypodcastnetwork.com.
www.buzzkillers.com.
Okay, Buzzkillers, we're back with Professor James Carter from St. Joseph's University talking about the interesting and very, very complicated history of Hong Kong in the last couple of hundred years. Professor, before we went on our sponsorship break, you were talking about the Hong Kong up to and including World War II and the immediate aftermath of World War II and the Chinese Civil War. What happens in the 50s and the 60s?
So the 50s and the 60s, again, is when Hong Kong, as we know it, and when I say as we know it, I really mean up until a couple of years ago, because it may have changed in fundamental ways. But in the 1950s, you've got a big population growth, largely of immigration from the mainland, from mainland China. So the two sort of things that are going on in parallel are this growth of Hong Kong as a Chinese city, because you have a huge influx from the mainland. Hong Kong also, keep in mind, is a colony.
Right.
And when we get to the protests that have been going on for the past year, a lot of that is about democracy. And there's been kind of a nostalgia for the colonial era. You'll even see some of the colonial flags flown in Hong Kong as looking back to a better time. Mm-hmm. That's really important to keep in context, because that was not, Hong Kong under British rule was not a democracy in any way. The British had plenty of opportunities to introduce democratic reforms into Hong Kong, but they did not. So Hong Kong certainly had a sort of a laissez-faire economic system. There was not a great degree of control exercised over the colony and over its finances. But it was a pretty segregated society. It was a pretty, it was colonial. There's no better way to put it. It was very colonial. Yeah. So that led to some tensions in the late 1960s. In the late 1960s, you have something called the Cultural Revolution in the mainland, which is really an attempt by Mao Zedong to lead a revolution against the Communist Party, which always sounds kind of strange since he is in many ways the head of the Communist Party, but he's leading a revolution against the party to maintain his own power. That spills out into Hong Kong, because you have a lot of people in Hong Kong who see importance in rebelling against the imperialism and colonialism that Hong Kong represents. And so you have riots in Hong Kong. You have a number of people killed. You have a number of police who are killed. You have many thousands of people, many tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, depending on the exact moment, are involved in these demonstrations in Hong Kong. And that leads to some reforms into the 1970s. And so in the 1970s, you start to see the growth of a Hong Kong identity, which you hadn't seen so much before. Because you start to see people now who have grown up in Hong Kong, they've lived in Hong Kong, and they've seen a Hong Kong that represents something distinct from China, and maybe distinct from a China that they didn't want to be a part of, because they have the ideological differences between the mainland and Hong Kong. So into the 1970s, I think you really see the beginnings of a more robust sense of Hong Kong identity, and that is, ironically, is overused, but maybe ironic that at the moment when you see Hong Kong starting to get its own identity, that's the moment at which its future comes into a lot of question. Because now, remember that 1997 breadcrumb that we had put down a little while ago, we now have to see that 1997, which seemed an awful long way away in 1898, is now creeping closer and closer. And in fact, in 1979 is the first time that a Hong Kong governor is invited to Beijing to meet with the leadership in Beijing, and the first discussions of, well, what might happen in the future take place.
So what does happen in 1979? What do those discussions entail?
Yeah, so Macalhose is the governor. I mean, if there was ever a better name for a colonial governor than Macalhose, I don't know what it is. But Macalhose goes to Beijing and he meets with Deng Xiaoping, who's the head of state and the head of the party. And Macalhose proposes that maybe we could just ignore 1997. I mean, that's basically his proposal. We just set it aside. He's not saying you have to commit to giving us Hong Kong forever. We're not saying we commit to renewing a lease. Can we just ignore 1997? And Deng Xiaoping rejects that. But Macalhose doesn't share that news widely. He goes to Beijing, and then he comes back, and he's very optimistic. He says, things are looking good. And that restores a lot of confidence in the future in 1979. but it's not based on anything. And so it becomes clear over the next couple of years that, oh, actually, we're not going to get Hong Kong back. The British are not saying we're not going to be able to hold on to Hong Kong. It is going to be reclaimed by the Chinese, because one thing that that kind of didn't make clear in the late 19th into early 20th century, when we talked about these different pieces of Hong Kong, mm-hmm. by 1970s, those three pieces are very tightly woven together. So there some people who said, kind of what you had asked about earlier, that there were some people who said, maybe we can just maintain, we can keep the island, but we can give back the rest of the new territories. Mm-hmm. A few people think that, but it's not really viable. In particular, water and food is all coming from the mainland. So there's issues in the 1960s when I talked about the unrest, like the power would get turned off or the water would get turned off. And it was very clear that Hong Kong is dependent on the tolerance of the mainland to continue to exist. So in 1982, negotiations begin formally between the British and the Chinese government. And in 1984, you have the signing of a joint declaration. And this joint declaration states what the conditions are going to be by which Hong Kong will return to Chinese sovereignty.
The return to Chinese sovereignty is in 1997, as it was outlined in 1898.
Yeah, July 1st, 1997. So just right around the anniversary of that. And that's another one of these anniversaries in Hong Kong that leads to celebrations or protests, depending on your point of view. So there's two really important things that come out of the agreement that leads to 1997, to the return. And aside from the obvious one, which is that the People's Republic of China assumes sovereignty over Hong Kong, you can't really say that it resumes sovereignty because the PRC never had sovereignty over Hong Kong.
It had been
a different country altogether. But the PRC is going to gain sovereignty. That's the most important bit. But there's two sort of conditions or features of it. So 1979 the topic is first broached. 1984, the Joint Declaration is signed. And that 1984 Joint Declaration points forward to 1997. And it lays out what's going to happen in 1997. And there's sort of three important features of it. So the most important, the fundamental one, is that China is going to resume sovereignty over Hong Kong, right? Actually, for the first time, the People's Republic of China is going to have sovereignty over Hong Kong, including the territory that was ceded in perpetuity, quote unquote. So that's going to go to China. That's the most important bit. But then there's two conditions. So one is this formula that Deng Xiaoping comes up with, which is called one country, two systems. Mm-hmm. And one country, two systems means that China, the People's Republic of China, is going to be the one country that Hong Kong will be a part of. But the two systems means that Hong Kong is going to continue to be capitalist, is going to continue to function in the same way that it had, even though the People's Republic is a communist country. And then the third bit, which is sort of some of the details of that one country, two systems, is that for 50 years after the handover, Hong Kong is guaranteed to maintain its own way of life and its capitalist system. So that's guaranteed until officially 2047. And that date is what has been causing a lot of the issues that we've seen in these protests over the past year or so, because there have been a number of people who have pointed to the fact that China agreed that Hong Kong would retain its own autonomy in all areas, except for national defense and foreign relations. All the internal dynamics within Hong Kong were to be handled by Hong Kong people. And they were to be handled internally and autonomously from the mainland. And so there have been steps, slow steps, and sometimes faster steps, that have eroded that autonomy. And it was really just about a year ago, that this first extradition law was proposed. It was couched in some sort of complex ways. It was about a murder case and somebody getting extradited from Taiwan back to Hong Kong, and it led to a lot of rethinking of the policy and the law. But there's very little doubt that the point of it was that the mainland wanted to be able to extradite people from Hong Kong to the mainland so that it could try them, it could make examples of them, it could imprison them, it could do any of the things that it's able to do to Hong Kong, to Chinese citizens in the PRC, that it couldn't easily do to Chinese citizens in Hong Kong, which is a really strange, and it's a strange kind of relationship because Hong Kong has had this for a long period of time. Up until, for a long time, Hong Kong citizens were kind of British citizens, but they didn't have the right of abode in Britain. Mm-hmm. Now, in a current arrangement, they're also sort of a special status of citizen compared to the rest of the People's Republic. So that's part of why the protests have been seen from different angles and with different perspectives, is because it's not at all cut and dried. It's not clear.
Does that mean that people are, in addition to these sort of tensions that come up every now and then over extradition and criminal charges and things like that, people in 2020 are looking at 2047 in similar ways that people in 1979 were looking at 1997, and that,
yes,
oh, there's this thing coming, and we think we sort of had put it off for a while, but we really don't know what's going to happen, and we want it to go a certain way, and yet Beijing wants it to go another way.
Yes, and there's different contexts to it. So, for instance, if I can go backwards just a little bit.
Yeah.
So in 1979, China was just opening for the first time under the communists. So for a couple of decades, China had been largely isolated, and Deng Xiaoping introduces these new policies. It's going to open. It's called reform and opening. It's when China is going to open to the world. And that begins this rapid economic growth that we're still seeing just now kind of coming to an end decades later. So in 1984, also remember that Tiananmen hasn't happened, the Tiananmen Square massacre, that hasn't happened yet.
Right.
So in 1984, this joint declaration is signed, and a lot of people are nervous about it, and some people are pessimistic and some are optimistic. But the reasons for optimism are easier to maintain because you haven't had so much of what's going to happen in a couple of years. So in 1989, that's when a lot of people in Hong Kong really start to be concerned. So it's like we were afraid that the state was going to be, that this, the PRC was going to be a problem, and now we have evidence for that.
Right.
And so a lot of people, for instance, in Hong Kong, find ways to emigrate to Australia or to emigrate to Canada. A lot of them get joint passports so that they'll have the option after 1997 that they might be able to go someplace else. I think by and large, there was a sense after 1997 that things were kind of okay. And so it wasn't a dramatic change. Not everybody would agree with that statement. Some people see some real erosion of freedoms going on. But for instance, that the commemoration of 1989, that continues in 1997, in 1998, it happens every year. And people have freedoms in Hong Kong, freedom of expression, freedom of assembly. They have these freedoms even after 1997. In the past few years, the pace at which those freedoms have been eroded begins to accelerate, matching, it has to be said, the repression in the mainland. So up until about 2008, you had seen more liberalization in the mainland. That starts to reverse after 2008. And you see the same thing in Hong Kong. So you see that echoes of that in Hong Kong, and you see more restrictions on speech. You've seen, for instance, some booksellers in Hong Kong that they disappear, and then they appear in the mainland in prison or being forced to make statements that are really worrisome. So there's this pace of change has accelerated over the past few years, and that's really what burst out into these protests that are ostensibly about the extradition bill. But they're really about sort of a more generalized anxiety about what is it going to look like, and this is how you put it, in 2047. We were hoping that in 2047 that the mainland might look a lot more like Hong Kong, and so the change would be more gradual. But now people are starting to see that maybe that isn't a realistic idea.
Well, that brings us really up to the recent disturbances. Now, again, we say recent from an American perspective because we only see this sort of full-fledged outbreak of trouble in the last few months. But as you said at the beginning of the show, they've been going on. The disturbances have been going on, and the protests have been going on for about a year.
Yeah, you see those disturbances going on, and even longer than that. So we had something that was called the Umbrella Movement. And the Umbrella Movement, which got its name from there's a famous photograph involving a young protester who's holding an umbrella, and he's surrounded by tear gas as it kind of wafts through. And in fact, it became illegal to go into the main. You couldn't carry umbrellas on airplanes going into the mainland for a period of time. because it was seen, it became such a symbol. So those protests took place in 2013, 2014. And it's hard to put a year on it because it happens kind of, they recur from time to time.
Right.
But the
right,
ones,
right.
the ones that emerged in 2019 in response to the extradition bill are larger in scale and scope than any that had come before. And so you start to have as many as 2 million people in these protests. And that amounts to something close to 50% of the population of Hong Kong.
Wow.
So I think the largest of them, I should have that number in front of me, the largest of them is more than 2 million people, but you have a number of them that are a million or 2 million people in the center of Hong Kong, and the total population, let's say, is something like 5 or 6 million. So when you get to these, you get to these places and you see this level of protest going on, it really is something that the you can't say, oh, it's just a... it's a few rabble rousers, or it's a small extreme segment of the population. It's a broad sense of protest and a broad sense of concern about what is going to become of Hong Kong.
Okay, so Professor, bring us up to the present day then.
Hong Kong's position since, you know, certainly since the 1830s and 40s, mm-hmm. Has really been as this interface between China and other parts of the world. And that continues to be the case right now. So, for instance, I was just reading a book by Anthony Dapiron, who's written a book called City on Fire, which is about the protests. And I was really struck by the fact that he spends a chapter talking about tear gas. And tear gas had been such a potent symbol that when it was used once in the umbrella movement, it was a real flashpoint that people looked and said, oh, my goodness, this really crosses a line. Yeah. And I realized that if I had read that a year ago, I might have had that same feeling. But now, not only is Hong Kong is tear gas being used in Hong Kong and has been used in Hong Kong a number of times during the 2019 into 2020 protests, but now in American cities, we're seeing tear gas being used. Yeah. So in terms of this point of connection, there's been more than once in my Twitter feed when I've been seeing riots and protests and demonstrations in Hong Kong and protests and demonstrations in the United States, and they've both been competing, you know, in my timeline for attention. And the causes of them are very different, but the optics, they look really very similar. And what I would say is a way that we can sort of try to understand what this connection is like is it's an odd, but I think really important piece. So folks in the American administration have looked at what's going on in Hong Kong at the passage of this new security law, which mm-hmm. went into effect, which was passed a couple weeks ago by the legislative body in Beijing. And it gave, it's a national security law that gives China sweeping powers in Hong Kong. And the American administration met this with a revocation of Hong Kong's special status, that the idea that there'd been a special trade status for Hong Kong because it was seen as being autonomous. And that's an important thing to keep in mind, is that officially Hong Kong is called the HKSAR, the Hong Kong Special Administrative Region.
Right.
Because of this law that was just passed, the American administration said Hong Kong is not meaningfully distinct from the rest of the People's Republic of China. Therefore, we're going to treat it in the same way as we've treated these other parts of the mainland. And that then leads to a really kind of troublesome cycle, which is if now Hong Kong isn't distinct, that reinforces Beijing's claim that Hong Kong is not distinct, that Hong Kong is part of the mainland. And so even though it's committed by this treaty to honor the one country, two systems and give Hong Kong this high degree of autonomy, we've now not only seen this breakdown because of the laws that are passed by Beijing, we're now starting to see it break down because of the policies that are instituted in Washington, which it has to be said are fair in terms of their observation that Hong Kong's freedoms are being eroded. And the point of that is to make that clear. But the effect of that may well be to further undermine Hong Kong's autonomy and independence.
Well, Professor, I certainly understand a lot more about what's going on there now than I did before. And these final things you said about the connections with the United States and even the sort of, you know, breaking point or turning point about tear gas is going to be absolutely fascinating to our listeners. So it just remains for me to say thank you very much for being on the show.
It's my pleasure. I really enjoyed the opportunity to have a chance to talk about these really pressing issues.
And we hope that you'll come back and talk to us more about other aspects of your field and your research.
Looking forward to it.
And just to say to the Buzzkillers that then we will talk to all of you next week.